Welcome to Ojibwe Stories, Gaga no Nidida. On today's program, we turn the interview mic around to talk with our own Ojibwe Stories host, Eric Reddix, about his latest book, The Murder of Joe White, Ojibwe Leadership and Colonialism in Wisconsin, published by Michigan State University Press. Dr. Eric Reddix is a member of the Lacoudere Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. He is an assistant professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He received his Ph.D. in history at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. From 2000 to 2004, he served as chair of the Division of Native American Studies at Lacoudere Ojibwe Community College. Hello, Eric. It's great to talk to you. To start off, for those who may not know, tell us a little bit about who Joe White was.
The book is centered, and the title obviously reflects this, around the murder of Joe White, who was a Lacoudere Ojibwe chief in the community that I'm from, the Lacoudere Reservation in northwest Wisconsin, about an hour and a half southeast of Duluth. And it's about the Ojibwe community of Gishkatawug, or Joe White. His community was located where modern-day Rice Lake, Wisconsin is, and that's about 50 miles southwest of the reservation. Throughout the 19th century, after the Treaty of 1854, which creates the Lacoudere Reservation, there's an effort made by federal officials, local government officials, the state of Wisconsin through enforcement of state game laws on Ojibwe people, as well as even corporate interest to get this community of Joe White onto the Lacoudere Reservation. So the murder refers to an incident in 1894 where state game wardens were increasingly enforcing state game laws on Ojibwe people, not just in northwest Wisconsin and not just in Wisconsin, but throughout northeast Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, upper Michigan. You know, we have those rights guaranteed in our, I mentioned the Treaty of 1854 that created the reservation also affirms our rights to hunt, fish, and gather off the reservation throughout the territory that was ceded, the home territory of the Ojibwe people. So a lot of people in the Rice Lake vicinity by 1894, you know, 40 years after the treaty was signed, wanted this community on the reservation. They didn't want Indians around anymore. So in 1894, a local Rice Lake judge issues a warrant for the arrest of Joe White for hunting deer off reservation. And, you know, he's the big cheese. He's the chief. So I see it as something that's really going to make a statement if they throw him in jail. So in the course of that arrest, they go about 20 miles north of Rice Lake, literally walking, and they finally catch up to Joe White's group. It includes his family, his wife, two of his children, including his stepson, Charles White, another man who later testifies at the trial of the murder of Joe White. His name was most likely Wabashashi. They catch up to this group, just under 10 people, and really Joe White's the only able-bodied, youngish adult male in that group. The rest were either kids or women, except for this Wabashashi. And they catch up to him, and they say, you know, we have this warrant for your arrest. You have to come back with us. He doesn't know what they're saying. He hardly speaks any English. His name, Joe White, his name, even in the annuity payments and that, is consistently Gishkatawug. Cut ear is what that literally means, and that's how, you know, he identifies. Joe White's the name that they gave him in these logging camps. They could pay him. They approach Joe White or Gishkatawug, and they say, you know, you're coming with us, and he kind of, you know, pulls back, and they take this, and, you know, this is a very modern story that we can relate to today, I think, with incidents like Ferguson, Missouri, and these other kind of places where you have excessive use of force by police and other officials. And so he pulls back, and they start beating him with handcuffs and the end of a shotgun, these two game wardens. And he's able to, you know, he's a strong, you know, kind of guy, so he's able to wiggle away from this. In the course of running away, they shoot him in the back, which kills him, a fatal gunshot wound. The modern-day newspaper reporter Frank Zufall down at the Spooner Advocate, who mentioned this to me, mentioned the fact that, you know, they just leave his body sitting there, and they walk back to Rice Lake. They send a telegram to, they believe, the local officials. But, you know, as far as that crime scene, they just leave his dead body there.
The family wasn't allowed to take him somewhere?
Well, the family took him, but as far as, you know, an investigation, it just kind of sat there. And actually, the family's allowed to later bury him, but the body lays there, and then it's later they come back and take up the body and perform an autopsy. But, I mean, for that first night, it just sat there, and they left the scene. Whereas, you know, today you wouldn't do that. You know, if there is a case of wrongdoing, yes or no, you stay with the, you know, and secure that scene. But right. They left.
Let's step back a second so I can make sure I understand the scene. You describe that the community was living on reservation and off reservation.
Right.
So they were not physically being restricted to living only on the reservation territory.
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the things, like, you know, when I went to do this book, I really wanted to know, like, you know, and again, being from Le Coup d'Oreille, you know, Native people, non-Native people are fairly aware of something like the Trail of Tears, where the government shows up with troops and forcibly removes Cherokee people from Georgia to Oklahoma. And I was like, well, what happened here? Why would somebody, you know, go to move on to the reservation? You know, our reservation encompasses two historic communities, one at Post or Pequawang, and the other one at Reserve, which was, you know, the original Le Coup d'Oreille community. But people are living all over the place. And once I did a little more research, I found out that Joe White's community, and specifically under the leadership of his father, Nana Ungavi, was the most populous community. And it got me more to thinking and wanting to know, like, why did they leave? And so the thing I found was that 1854, the reservations created. If you look at that tree, it just says three townships at Le Coup d'Oreille. The Bad River Reservation over by Ashland, that's one where it specifies, you know, from this point to this point, crosses this creek, you know, etc. But it just says three townships. So there's a whole battle after the treaty is put into effect in the 1860s, kind of almost within the Le Coup d'Oreille band, between the chief at Le Coup d'Oreille Lake, where the reservation is today, Akawainzi, and Joe White's brother. And I mentioned a Wabashashi earlier, but that was a different man. Wabashashi is a very common name in the 19th century. But Joe White's brother, Wabashashi, who's the chief at the time, he kind of has a battle, and they really want the reservation to be down at Rice Lake. And for a year, they kind of get their way. I saw in federal correspondence in 1858 where they say the Indians want the reservation at Rice Lake proper, but a little bit further south down by Chautauqua, Wisconsin, at a place called Prairie Rice Lake. Today, it's known as Prairie Lake. That's what sustained not only Joe White's community, but the entire LCO band, and arguably probably some communities that lived in the St. Croix band as well. They say that lake could sustain 2,000 people in a season. It could feed, you know.
Wow.
You know, that was a big rice lake. And today, you know, there's no rice on it. It's just called Prairie Lake. So, but after that, you know, after the Wabashashi's community kind of loses that battle throughout the 1870s, there's more pressure for this community to remove. The Barron County Board, Rice Lake is in Barron County, still is today, petitions the federal government and says, get these Indians out of here. They belong on the reservation at Le Coup d'Oreille. And I guess, you know, one of the cases of good federal inefficiency and whatnot, they just say, well, we're not, you know, we'll look into that. And it doesn't go any further. So, but it just shows that there are these citizens, these white settlers in Barron County that are upset about the Indians being there.
The conflict, was it really about gaming, or was it about trying to enforce an idea of constraining them to the reservation? Was it an idea about trying to, you said before that they were allowed to hunt off reservation as well as on reservation. They were allowed to live off reservation as well as on reservation. Is the deeper motion here about trying to restrict their movement and their hunting rights to within the reservation, or?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not only their hunting rights, but the hunting rights are kind of tangential to what they want. To a lot of these settlers, not all, but a lot of these settlers just wanting Indians, and this is how they put it, of course, Indians to stay on the reservation. So I don't know necessarily that a lot of these town officials, general settlers, whatever, were that upset about the numbers of deer they were taking. But I think they're more concerned with just Indians going off reservation and being there. And if they enforce game laws onto Native people, then they'll stay on the reservation. And it's a federal-state issue, too, and a federal-local issue because, you know, they say basically, well, the federal government can give them commodities and they can take care of them. You know, it's their problem. So there's always a passing the buck.
It's funny what you were saying about hunting too many deer. And a classic example of excess in hunting that comes to mind is the eradication of the American buffalo by white migrants throughout the 1800s, just leaving the bodies to rot. And I can't imagine that in the Ojibwe community that they're killing deer in excess for any reason, that you'd never let a deer go to waste.
Zero evidence that that was the case. More modern times, when we go out and spear fish, there's no evidence there, too, that hurts the resource at all. I mean, we're just trying to feed our families, as I'm sure they were in the case of deer hunting, especially back then, because they were really poor in the 19th century. There's a fairly well-known American historian, Bill Cronin, who wrote this book and talks about how the people of plenty were a people of waste. I think he has something like that. And he talks about how American expansion, there is so much waste. And I talk about that too.
In the modern age, there seems to be hunting for sport.
Mm-hmm.
And sport hunting is entirely different than hunting for survival.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, it's just kind of funny that they would say something like that. You know, when we go out, it's not for sport. It's not necessarily put a trophy on our wall. It's to feed our family. families, and definitely that was the case back then for Ojibwe people. So, but I mean, that's really the problem, and that's what a lot of scholars and other observers say, is that even in the 1980s, when Wisconsin was going through treaty rights controversy, there's something upsetting to a lot of people that it isn't a sport. And because they view it as such. So, You know, another good example of waste, too, that I talk about in the book is that, you know, Joe White worked in the timber industry and, you know, just the land loss that Lac-Couture suffered. And I talk a lot about the timber industry, not just on the reservation, but off as well. And there's so much waste in the timber industry, and especially that first wave. They're only interested in white pine. So you see examples of settlers coming in, selling their white pine timber, and then the other trees that grow in old growth forests, sugar maple, yellow birch, especially hemlock, because hemlock you can't really use for firewood. They just take those hemlocks and they just burn them. And that's how they settled the land, and that's how they used the resource, you know. And I mean, a 300-year-old hemlock tree, just cut it down, either let it rot or burn it.
The statehood of Wisconsin was in the
1848.
So at that point, were there some Indian territories that were outlined that were larger than... By the time we get to the 1890s, were they smaller?
The reservations are created in 1854. But even then, you know, I mean, Wisconsin claims the territory all the way up to Superior, Ashland, et cetera, is part of Wisconsin. But it really isn't, you know. And one of the things that kind of influenced me writing the book, and I think would influence anybody looking at this history, is a book by historian Michael Witkin, who teaches over at Michigan. And he's Red Cliff Ojibwe, and he talks about the 200-300 years prior to that when the British and the French would make these claims. And later he talks a little bit about Americans, too, making these territorial claims that he says are bogus. You know, I mean, this isn't French territory. This isn't British territory. This is native autonomous territory. And really, you can make that argument even well into the 1850s. And when they make that treaty and they say, we're going to put you on reservations, it means nothing. It really doesn't. By and large, all the way south to maybe where Highway 8 is today, you know, maybe even that far south, this is effectively Ojibwe territory in 1854.
So the claim of basically drawing a line in a map and saying here's where things are doesn't really describe how things really are.
No, it really doesn't. It's really kind of a bogus claim. You know, we see these things as inevitable, right, because of what happened. And we know that the majority of people that live in our region now are non-native, and native people by and large live on reservations and this, that, and the other thing. But, you know, you have to think back and think that they had no way of knowing that. And really what enables what we have today isn't so much these claims that people are making in the 1840s, 1850s. It's the Industrial Revolution in the 1860s and 1870s. I mean, that's what really makes this happen. They want it to happen, but they don't really have the technology to make it happen.
Well, I'll point out that perhaps, of course, another thing that makes this happen are events just like this with Joe
White. Right, and this is how that plays out in the ground. So, you know, we might have this idea that, you know, people sign treaties and then they go to the reservation. But what this book is really about is 40 years after that treaty is signed to going to the reservation. It's not an automatic thing, and it's certainly not a trail of tears, removing you at gunpoint thing. There are these much subtler, much more, you could say, ineffective ways that these different entities are impacting this community. You know, white settlers, local governments, state governments, federal government, and they all have... You know, they don't all get together in a smoky room and say, let's do this. In fact, it's very much how we think of governments today. Sometimes inept, sometimes ineffective. Sometimes that ineptness and ineffective is good for Ojibwe than the community and their goals. Sometimes it's actually more effective than if they had brought the army in. It's a complicated thing. And I think that the role of this book within my community was to, and within Ojibwe communities, was to understand that better. But also I think it plays a role in our kind of understanding of American history, American Indian history broadly, that there's more to what we think about than just Wounded Knee or the Trail of Tears. And they're tragedies, but they're somewhat more easy to understand because there's an army there, you know, and they show up and we can understand that. But this is far more complicated.
This is Ojibwe Stories, a program of Ojibwe culture. We are talking today with our regular host, Eric Reddix, about his latest book, The Murder of Joe White, Ojibwe Leadership and Colonialism in Wisconsin, published by Michigan State University Press. Dr. Reddix is a member of the Lac-Couture Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. He is an assistant professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth. I was thinking about an analogy of what you were saying before, that a lightning strike is easy to define, but gradual climate change is a lot harder to understand. And in some ways, it seems what you're describing is it's a 40 or 50 year process of not just moving people lock, stock, and barrel at one moment,
but creating a culture where eventually they are sort of forced, pushed over in a way that's a much more, as you say, insidious process of creating a gravity where eventually they are so uncomfortable where they are, they have to just give up and slowly migrate.
Right, and this is several decades, you know. People were born, you know, after this treaty was created, they became adolescents, they had kids of their own. Mm. All within this no man's land, you know, I mean, status of like, well, you can stay here. It's not just that there's a few lingering Indians. I talk about in the center chapter about Wabashashi, Joe White's brother, and the fact that he was the chief for 22 years. And it's after the Treaty of 54, and it's basically once the reservation, it's decided it's going to be at Lac Ray, he says, I don't want anything to do with it. And I'm going to stay here, and this is going to be our community, and we're going to interact with these white settlers. He has a lot of successes. He has a lot of failures. You know, during that time, Rice Lake itself, as well as Prairie Rice Lake that I mentioned, is flooded, completely obliterating that rice. And it really undermines the ability of that community to stay there, but it doesn't end it. When he dies in 1877, they're still there. So that's a big chunk of time where he said, this is the way it's going to be. Mm. So it's not a small amount of time. It's not just a little phase. It's not just a temporary thing. And in anybody's mind, even the white settlers, you know, that's probably why they were so adamant 17 years after Wabashashi dies, for the ones that were really opposed to having Indians around, this was their final effort at saying something needs to happen here, you know, and you know, I don't say this explicitly in the book, but my, you know, my feeling about this is that this was a conscious thing. We're going to take out the guy at the top.
Remind me the year again of this particular conflict.
The Joe White is murdered in 1894.
94.
So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, again, the treaty is 1854. The reservation at Lac Ray, they don't even do that. It isn't officially established on paper till 1873, but the reservation being in the vicinity of Rice Lake, Chautauq area, that is late 1850s, 1859. Mm. So, you know, it's a long time.
Yeah. Were the goals of the white community, as far as creating some change because of this conflict, how long did it take to have that actually happen? Did it happen? How long did it take?
At no point is it really a done deal. Prior to the murder of Joe White in the 1880s is the allotment of the Lac Ray Reservation. An allotment was something that impacted Native peoples nationally through the Dawes Act, but in our region, we have allotment through the Treaty of 1854. What I talk about are these kind of federal efforts that are more subtle to rope people into reservation life. And so when they start allotting the reservation, it has to do with timber profits, first and foremost. But it also has to do with the fact that the agent is kind of co-opting the community of Akawainzi, who I mentioned, who lives at Lac Ray, to stay on the reservation more. And, you know, the reservation's within his community. There's almost this divide in the 1880s where Joe White is the leader of this renegade band, if you will, in the eyes of the Indian agent, and the Akawainzi community is the one more playing ball. And those are the subtle ways that they try to, and I say try to, rope the community into, and more members of the community into, staying on the reservation full time. Some in the community in the 1880s take their allotments and move on to the reservation. And Joe White spent some time on the reservation. In fact, in 1894, he's headed back to the reservation when they catch up with him. But he was adamant that he was going to make part of his living both through wage labor, because he's a logger not on the reservation but off. His wage labor and his kind of traditional hunting, fishing, whatever, that's in the traditional areas along around Long Lake and Rice Lake, where the community had always been. So the Indian agent then, Joseph Gurno, who actually has descendants at Lac Ray, he was a mixed-blooded guy from the Red Cliff community from Lake Superior. He, because he can speak English as well as French and Ojibwe, he's employed as the government agent, and he has a conflict with Joe White. So there's this scene where it's not only through the Allotment Act, which is something I talk about, where the agents are trying to target, and they call it, you know, the renegade band or whatever, or the off-reservation bands. You know, if we can get them to take allotments to live on the reservation, what happens is Gishtawag, he gets his personal allotment patented in 1881, one of the very first ones, and he doesn't want to live there, and he just wants to sell the timber, collect the money, and that's it. And likewise, government commodities. You know, we still have commodities today that the federal government issues to low-income Native people, but that was one of their first attempts to rope these people in, and explicitly saying, you know, you don't necessarily have to rely on hunting, fishing. We have food for you. Gishkatawa, Joe White, you know, unlike his brother, who has nothing to do with the federal government, you know, the first thing that Joe White, in becoming chief in 1877, he says, they're offering some land, some timber sales, some food. I'll take it, but I ain't going anywhere. So what he does in 1882, he comes up to Lacouture and he comes up and demands his share of the government rations. And he has this confrontation with Joseph Gournau, the government agent, who himself, like I say, is a mixed-blooded Ojibwe person, was very much an assimilated Ojibwe person. He was an employee of the federal government, so he had the federal government's goals in mind. And Joseph Gournau wrote to his superior in Washington about Joe White. He said, if I would not willingly give it to them, meaning the rations, they would take it. And if I interfered, he, the head man, a murderer, which I'll talk about why he calls him that in a little bit, would put an end to me. So, you know, basically, Gishkatawa comes up to the reservation and says, give me the food. And when he refuses, he says, all right, well, I'm going to get this food no matter what. I don't know if he specifically said he would kill him, but he calls him a murderer. And this is kind of this cultural disconnect I talk about between Joseph Gournau, who's assimilated, an English speaker, a French speaker. He's a Catholic. He's very removed from Ojibwe communities. And, you know, one of the ways that shows is how he calls Gishkatawa a murderer. And what this stems from is Wabasheshe, Gishkatawa's brother, Joe White becomes the chief when Wabasheshe is killed by somebody in the community. And we don't know why he was killed. It's not natural causes. It's foul play by somebody named Bedud within the community. So the next year, Gishkatawa, who is now the chief, takes Bedud's life. And this is fairly common in native communities. And it's also fairly common for white settlers coming into contact with us to say, oh, this is a blood feud. This is revenge. But in actuality, you know, in our traditional ways of criminal justice, in order for Joe White's brother, the former chief, for his spirit to move on, either Joe White's family could have decided that a payout was in order, or he had every right to just bypass that step and take Bedud's life. And he did that in 1878. So this is where Joseph Gournau says, this guy's a murderer. No, he's not a murderer. It's just that that was Ojibwe's traditional system of criminal justice.
What prevents that perpetuating? I mean, does somebody else then need to avenge that man by killing Joe White? I mean, how does that...
Right. Well, because, I mean, you know, it's recognized as a murder. It's an assassination. So had it been something where, say, you know, say Wabasheshe had killed one of Bedud's relatives, Joe White wouldn't have killed Bedud. And that's fairly accepted. Nobody comes after Joe White after he kills Bedud. The community recognizes that he had a right to do this, and that's the end of it. But it's not the end of it in the eyes of assimilated people like Joseph Gournau and whites. They view it as just like, oh, these Indians are out of control. This is another reason we want them out of here.
After he was killed, who became chief in his wake?
Because so many of them live on the reservation, there isn't a clear successor. One of the things that happens as well during this time is the community splits further. So even after Joe White's murder, there is, even into 1910, there is a few families still living in the vicinity of Long Lake. The community splits, and that kind of throws things into question as far as the leader of the community. Joe White's son doesn't take over, which was the kind of the historical way that would pan out. He didn't have any other, you know, younger brothers himself. So what ends up happening, and I talk about this in the last chapter of the book, is there's a variety of ways, though, that leadership is kind of perpetuated. And, you know, the first thing that happens, and this happens to Native people all over, is that the more people are on the reservation, they're hooked into the agent. And before we had tribal councils recognized by the federal government, the Indian agent really ran the entire reservation. The other thing that happens, too, is that, you know, it's not dead, that leadership role. And in fact, the last chapter I talk about the growth of our and Larry Smallwood and Mick has talked about big drum ceremonies in our communities. And I talk about how the Whitefish community, which becomes where all the people from Rice Lake go, the Whitefish community on the reservation, that becomes kind of a mecca for big drum, not just on LCO, but nationally. There's people that come from Oklahoma to come to Whitefish ceremonies, but under the leadership of Gishkatawa's nephew, Steve Grover. Steve Grover was the son of Minotagus, who was Joe White's sister. And he becomes a charismatic, albeit very, very controversial, big drum leader. But regardless of how we feel about him today, he was a very influential leader. And Joe White's other sister, Ajawea, who's a kind of a well-known figure on the reservation today, known as a woman warrior who fought the Dakotas, and her son, Thomas Bracklin, asserts a leadership role. And he tries to do it bureaucratically. He tries to work for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He kind of asserts this leadership role, and he tries to do it from the inside. So he applies to become an Indian agent, and they put him at Red Cliff. And in the midst of that, there's this stern letter from the Commission on Indian Affairs that said, I posted this job on the condition it did not go to an Indian person. And so within 3 months, they don't say that's the reason, but within 3 months, he's relieved of his duties.
Huh.
You know, this federal apparatus really does come down hard in the 20th century as far as traditional leadership structures. You know, there's a leader named, I mentioned him before, Akwaenzi, who's the leader of the hereditary leader at Le Coup d'Etat. And, you know, Akwaenzi made some strong defense of Indian rights. But, you know, at the same time, during this era, he is more so, I got to be careful how I put this. But, and again, you know, when we talk about these figures, you know, we can't be beholden to how our ancestors were either way. But, you know, Akwaenzi is, you know, fondly remembered, and I think rightfully so. But, you know, the reality is in the 1880s, he was very much more playing ball with the federal government compared to Joe White. You know, if we want to think about who is more aggressively fighting for things, it's Joe White, and it's not Akwaenzi. You know, Akwaenzi does some very good things for the community, but he's very much, you know, playing ball with the agent. So. And that's not to say anything about Akwaenzi, his character, or, you know, his descendants that later kind of play a role, because all those people did a lot of good stuff for the rights of Le Coup d'Etat people. But, I mean, really, realistically, in the 1880s, you know, Joe White's the rebel and Akwaenzi is the more centrist figure. I'll read this quote from the Rice Lake paper, because one of the things that happens at the end, these two game wardens, they go to trial, and The end of it is they're found not guilty of, and they're set free. You know, it's one of those things that I talk about the jurors in there and how most of them were from Scandinavia and they had similar interests to, you know, the towing the party line as far as settlement and getting the, you know, Ojibwe back onto the reservation. So, you know, the strongest piece of evidence I kind of see that ties the not guilty verdict and everything together is this quote from the Rice Lake Chronotype. And again, this is important because this was the headquarters of the community throughout the 19th century. And to me, it puts an end not to leadership within this community, certainly, not even, again, as I mentioned before, to Indians living off the reservation. There's a significant, you know, small but significant community of families living in Long Lake into the 20th century in wigwams. So, but as far as Rice Lake is concerned, this is kind of the period at the end of this, you know, this quote talking about the verdict. And it says, quote, "Chronotype has no desire to discuss the unfortunate affair, as it believes that justice has been done to all concerned, with the possible exception of the taxpayers of Washburn County, who have had a needless expense saddled upon them through the medium of incompetent officials who listened to the old grannies at Shell Lake and forced a trial when an intelligent investigation of the killing at the time of its occurrence would have clearly demonstrated what the trial has now done, the taking of Joe White's life was not only justifiable, but an imperative necessity," unquote. So again, that just shows that, And I hope readers come across this same thing, you know, both our native readers and non-native readers, that, you know, this action, this murder of Joe White was not just about police resistance or was about even hunting and fishing, that it really was about an imperative necessity to get this community on the reservation and to have this segregated America, really, where there's Indians on one side and white people on the other.
That's all the time we have for today on Ojibwe Stories. Our thanks to our regular host, Eric Reddix, for sharing this piece of Ojibwe history with us. His book, The Murder of Joe White, Ojibwe Leadership and Colonialism in Wisconsin, is published by Michigan State University Press.
To listen again to past episodes of the program, visit the KUMD website at kumd.org and click on Audio Archives. Ojibwe Stories Gaganunidada is produced by KUMD and by the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth, home of the Master of Tribal Administration and Governance, or MTAG program, where students learn about leadership, law, sovereignty, and management from a tribal perspective. MTAG was designed by tribes for tribes. More information at umdmtag.org. Funding for Ojibwe Stories Gaganunidada is provided in part by the UMD College of Education and Human Service Professions and by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.